Hi, this is Joe Patti. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We had occasion to speak with Mr. Barenboim in advance of his performance at the Kimmel Center on December 8th in a solo recital.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Mr. Barenboim.
Yes.
Hi, Jill Pasternak here in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Ah, you are so busy, I know.
No, it's okay.
This is the second time we've spoken. You don't know, but I met you at Le Cirque one time.
How about that?
Yeah, and I saw you. I had lunch there, and I walked over to you, and you were very gracious. You stood up, and you bowed, and you said thank you very much.
Well, I wanted to show you that the age of chivalry is there.
You were very chivalrous, I have to tell you. I was moved by it. But so, in any case, you have very good taste in food. I'm going to make this rather quick. I know you had a very, very busy schedule. I think the one thing I want to ask you is, you know, you've achieved, and not only achieved, but sustained a remarkable dual career as both a virtuoso pianist and a highly acclaimed conductor. How do you do that?
Because the main thing that interests me are my books.
Your books?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you clarify?
Well, three of those have come out now.
Oh, okay.
The first one was A Life in Music.
Oh, yes, yes.
The second was a book I wrote with Edward Said.
The Parallels and Paradoxes. Yeah.
And the third one just came out in America now.
Is that Music Awakens or Quickens Time?
Yeah.
Quickens. That's an interesting title as well.
You know, and when I say that this is this is a result of really what I think and my reflections, and this is what really fascinates me all the time, that music is something so unusual, because every time you play or you conduct something, you find out something new about
yes,
it every single time. It's never the same. And it's always some aspect which is new that you hadn't quite noticed exactly in that form. And therefore, when you start today, you have more knowledge than yesterday, but you still have to start from scratch, because sound does not remain. You have to start from scratch. And it is this combination of having more knowledge, knowing more, and yet having to start from scratch. But I don't know another parallel to that in life.
Well, the thing is, I guess I'm talking about the energy that it requires. I mean, you have to practice, you have to keep up repertoire technically.
No, you have to think. You have to think. This is the most important thing. Musicians forget about it, and people who talk about musicians forget about it. You have to really think. If you really think constantly and develop your thoughts about the music and about its content and about its meaning and things, then you find the time and you find the energy. But if you do it only as something that you have to do as a career or something that you have to practice and think and never think about it, you'll never get to it anywhere.
Well, I think I'm talking about the physicality of it, because it's, you know.
Yeah, but the physicality of it is not the problem. It's the mental that is
okay.
Not the problem, if you want, but the interesting aspect.
Now, you're making your Met debut as a conductor with Tristan and Isolde. You've done that opera many times, haven't you?
Yes.
With other orchestras. This is a very big thing for you, right? To make a Met opera debut.
Well, I've conducted I played my first concert in New York over 50 years ago, in January of 57 at Carnegie Hall, and I've conducted every conceivable orchestra in New York in these 50 years, and I've only conducted opera in concert form in New York.
I see.
So I'm very happy to conduct opera in opera form.
The real thing, huh?
Yes.
Well, this again, this even extends your abilities as a conductor. I always felt, of course, I was told that that conductors very often start as opera conductors and then go into symphonic conducting.
Yeah, many do.
Yeah, but I was. I think it should be the other way around because there's so much more that you have to concentrate on. Is that
yes
true?
Yes and no. You know, yes and no. Both systems have their advantages and disadvantages. If you start in the opera world, you learn so much about the practicality of the how to maintain control over such a distance, people on stage and in the pit and off stage, and get used to. You get also wonderful richness of the associations with text, which you don't have when you conduct only symphonic music. And you start from that. What you lack then is the necessity to deal with the details and with the of sound and of balance and of musical thought, if you want, of the intimacy of musical thought. If you do it the other way around, which was my way, I came from the piano and from chamber music, and then from symphonic music into opera, you come with a much richer musical baggage, but you have quite a lot to learn about
the relationship, I guess.
About the relationship with theater, with stage, about also conducting-wise, you know, the necessity to constantly lead and accompany, and go from one to the other, which you have to do much more than when you're simply a symphony conductor.
Yes, that's so very interesting. The whole
It's a very interesting subject, actually. Both, like everything in life, both systems have their advantages and disadvantages.
Now, if nothing's perfect, though.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the other thing that you've done, I know here in Philadelphia, we're one of the four, I think you're giving four solo recitals on your tour.
At the Met, Philadelphia, and Chicago.
And you chose, I think here you're going to be playing an all Liszt program?
The same program I play at the Met. It's a program of Liszt and Italy. It's the three connections that Liszt had to Italy. One is to Italian literature. That's why the Petrarca sonnets and
so
Dante, after the reading Dante. One is of Liszt, the religious part, you know, that he, at the end of his life, became an abbe, a priest in Rome.
Really?
This is St. Francis preaching the
walking
birds.
Walking on water? With the birds, that's
with
it.
With the birds?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And the third aspect is the connection between Liszt and Verdi. And the second half are operatic paraphrases of Aida, Rigoletto, and Trovatore.
Not a very ambitious program, huh?
Pardon?
Not a very ambitious
program. No.
Well, it just rolls. I mean, you really chose it. That sounds spectacular.
No, but I have to say, and I hope you or Philadelphia will not take it amiss. I chose this program for the Met because, especially with the opera paraphrases, it's wonderful to play this for an opera audience who really know these pieces.
Yes, they recognize the thematic material. Yeah, but again, for pianists, this is an amazing, technically amazing.
Program,
it's wonderful.
Yes.
Now, another question. You are so multifaceted, and of course that you're well aware of that. The West Eastern Divan Orchestra, that's a fascinating subject as well, and you're still quite active with that, right?
Oh, I'm very much active with it. I'm very much active. This is now our 10th year now. It was founded by Edward Said and I in 1999.
Yes.
So it's 10 years now.
He has since passed away, hasn't he?
Yes.
Yes. Do you think, how do I put this?
I think it will bring peace to the Middle East, no?
Yes. No, not bring peace, but do you think it'll ever work?
What, in the Middle East?
Yeah.
Well, Either it will work or we will kill each other.
That's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, but it's been going on for a long time. You have to ask yourself why. You know, and the reason why is because I think people, both in the region and outside, but especially outside, do not really have the honesty to regard the problem as it is for what it is.
What
it's not a political conflict like hundreds of political conflicts that we have known through history. A political conflict is a conflict between two nations that have disputes about water, about petrol, about gas, about borders, and these kind of conflicts can be solved diplomatically, and if that fails, militarily. Since time immemorial, since the Roman Empire and before. This, however, is not this kind of a political conflict. It is a human conflict between two peoples who are deeply convinced they have the right to live on the same little piece of earth.
Okay, so that.
And if you treat that as a political conflict, you will get no solution. It's like, you know, you have a heart condition and you are giving medicine for cancer.
Right. Well, do you think the problem started when they divided? I mean, that was really in the beginning, right before the independence of Israel. I mean, the Arabs and Jews were living together fairly well before that, weren't they?
The difficulty is, if you go back, of course, you know, then you have to go back to 1920 during the First World War, when the Jews were only 15% of the population of Palestine. Mm. But then you can claim on the other side there was no Palestinian entity, they were part of Greater Syrian, etc., etc., etc. So it's very difficult to know how far to go back and where it starts. I think the problem is that you have to have a solution that is a result of a reflection of the past, that is, plus understanding of the realities of today. And the realities of today are that there is Israel as a nation, not anymore a persecuted minority in Europe, a nation with a strong army, and a Palestinian people that have, in the meantime, acquired a national identity which has not been satisfied, and that the one and the other do not go hand in hand, and that it's very difficult for the ones to accept the existence of the others, and that unless they do that, and unless they come to the realization that there can only be a solution that is good for both, and not good for one and bad for the other, which is what everybody has been attempting, it will not work.
Well, now here you have a situation with music, our international language of music, and in this orchestra you have Arabs and Israelis, and even, I mean, culturally, even the music, the Arab music is different, and yet somehow you bring the Western and the Eastern together, and they play. I mean, there is an understanding there, isn't it?
Of course. Oh, there's a perfect understanding, but there's no question about it. And music is a great lesson for life, because if you play intelligently in an orchestra, what do? You express yourself to the utmost, otherwise you're not contributing enough.
Right.
But you have to simultaneously, therefore, at the same time, listen to what the other is playing. I mean, what a lesson for life do you want?
Oh, of course, that's
Express
it.
Express yourself and listen to the others. And this, for our, that's why I like to think of the West Eastern Divan as not just an orchestra. It's almost like an independent sovereign republic, you know. When we get together and we live together in the summer, our rules don't apply anywhere else, and the rules from anywhere else don't apply to us.
Well, it's a utopian situation.
It's a realistic utopia.
Realistic, yeah. And how do you get they're young people, aren't they, mostly?
They are young people, yeah, but in the meantime, they've grown up. You know, many of them have been there for 10 years. Three of them are members of the Berlin Philharmonic. One is in the Bayerischer Rundfunk, or many orchestras in Europe.
So you have a constant influx of new talent.
We keep about 65 or 70% are the same.
And the relationships are good.
You know, an orchestra has all kinds. Has open people and closed people, curious people, and not so curious, intelligent people and not so intelligent. So there are those who have contact and those who just come and have the contact in the summer, and that's it.
So this is a project. How did you get involved with that, with Mr. Saeed? I mean, did you?
I didn't get involved with Mr. Saeed. I took him along then.
Uh-huh.
I got involved with it because Weimar,
was
declared cultural capital of Europe in 1999. Mm-hmm. And they approached me to see whether I would help them build a music program.
I see.
And so that's how we came to this, because Weimar represents both the very best and the very worst in German history. It was the city of Goethe, Liszt and Schiller and all that, and it's only 5 kilometers away from the Buchenwald concentration.
Well, this is another question I wanted to ask you, and of course, how does one answer? I mean, you have a marvelous relationship with the orchestras in Germany. You've been honored many, many times over, all over the world. You were born in Buenos Aires, right?
Right.
That's another subject. I guess they allowed the Nazis and the Jews into Argentina. But do you have any baggage with that at all? I mean, do you, as an ambassador of art, do you divorce yourself from any, I guess, political or, I guess, emotional ties?
You mean as far as the German thing is concerned?
Yes, the whole situation.
Well, first of all, you have to, I think one has to understand and recognize that the German people and the different governments over the last 6 years have done every conceivable effort to come to terms with their past.
Yes, right.
And it's been, I'm sure, very difficult for many of them. And they have done that. And they have tried to put this in proportion to the long history as one of the darkest periods in
civilization,
in world history.
Yes.
But only that, only a period. In other words, you cannot reduce 400 years of German culture and German philosophy and German music to 15 years of the Nazis. Dreadful as it was, and it was horrible and monstrous and unique in the history of mankind, it's only 15 years. And I think the Germans have done everything since then humanly possible to come to terms with it. I'm also not one that believes in distributing collective guilt, and therefore you cannot really maintain a relationship of distributing guilt to generations and generations after.
You are.
Thirdly, the most important of all, I think, the Jewish people went through a big change. In other words, they were minorities for 20 centuries.
Yes.
We were minorities for 20 centuries, sometimes well-received, sometimes persecuted with vehemence and cruelty. And then we landed up in 1948 having a state of our own.
Amazing.
A nation of our own with a strong army and a strong this and a strong that. But we still try to keep part of our psychic and part of our mentality as a diaspora persecuted minority. That's not on. We have to decide, do we want to be a nation, and if you want, be proud of being patriotic, or do we want to be simply an example of nationalism full of anguish, anger, and fear? And this is what the politics of the State of Israel have been for these last years.
But
and this is very unhealthy for the future of Israel.
But I think that people don't even talk about the Jews as wherever they come from, say American or Russian, or it's they're Jews first. We don't say that, but they say, the big they say, you're Jews first, and that's wrong. If you if you're born in a country, isn't that your national?
But no, heritage? I don't think that is a. I don't think this is a question. The question is that Israel cannot make a foreign policy based on that, based on European anti-Semitism.
Okay, that's exactly what I'm asking you. That's
you know,
exactly.
I would much rather we had a proud Israel that was a nation that was strong, that was generous, that had contributed to the building up of Palestinian civic society, that had built schools in Ramallah and in Bethlehem and all that, and hospitals and all that. We would be in a much better position for ourselves now than that.
Do you think there's a possibility of changing the philosophy?
We are much too late. But maybe it's not too late.
Never too late. No, it's an amazing situation because it's how many years now of war?
60. And we have been sitting on these territories for 41 years. One of the longest occupations in history. And what have we done that? In every occupying situation, it is the responsibility of the occupier to be responsible for the quality of life of the occupied. And that's why I ask the same question. Where are the schools that we bought? Where are the hospitals that we bought, we built? Where are, where is the administrative infrastructure that we have built there? Nothing. Why? We have to admit it. Because we never thought we would stay there and because we thought they would go.
Well,
but
maybe,
they're not going to go.
Maybe it's not an easy decision.
Of course it's not easy.
No.
But what is easy in life?
Well,
but we cannot, as Jewish people in 2008, we cannot keep using the same language from 20 centuries of persecution. We have a country of our own.
Yes.
And we have to do the best we can to build it up and to do something good with it, instead of thinking all the time, what are the others saying about us?
Now, one other thing that you do, which is actually to the core of what I love, is you play tango. That is an amazing.
Very occasionally. I haven't for years.
Oh, it's just an amazing thing. I went to Buenos Aires twice, and I am a tango buff. So
well, there you are. Me too.
You have. Was it an album that you made?
Yes. Yeah.
Tango Argentina was.
Yeah,
that
there's also a video from a New Year's Eve concert in Buenos Aires.
Do you do the tango?
Pardon?
Do you dance the tango?
Yes, I can. Yes.
Ah, that's wonderful. Well, Maestro, I am so very, very happy that you took the time out.
No,
I know
it was a pleasure to chat with you.
And I hope to see you in Philadelphia. I'm going to come to that concert.
Wonderful. But please come by and say hello.
I certainly will.
All right.
And
thank you.
Good luck. Thank you. Bye-bye.